Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Hidden Lives of Writers. I'm Fiona Snickers, and I'm joined by my co-host, Gail Schimmel. Gail, how have things been going this week?
Oh, I see what you did there. You tricked me into speaking first. Okay, so this week I have done something very interesting. First of all, I want to report back that my morning writing is still going well. I'm managing it, and good. I'm being kind to myself if I have a meeting or something and I can't do it. So I'm very happy with that. But I had a very interesting task very recently where my agent asked me for a chapter-by-chapter synopsis of my latest book, and I don't have the capacity at the moment to be doing chapter-by-chapter synopses, and I'm not... it's been a hard book for me for some reason, and I thought that going back into that world I wasn't going to cope with at all. So I said in my head, I wrote an email explaining why I was not going to do this, but I would do a quick overview. And when I did the quick overview, it actually almost became a chapter by chapter synopsis, except I did groupings, chapter 1 to 10, da da da. Mm-hmm. And it was much easier than I thought it would be. And the world came back to me much quicker than I thought it would. Mm-hmm. And I found it interesting in that you write about a world, you leave it. I'm deep in another world writing a different book, but that world's still there waiting for you. And when you go back into it, it's still there. And it says, oh, here you are. Remember what happened. And it came back so quickly. So that was very interesting. What about you, Fiona? Anything interesting this week?
Well, I wanted to report back on how my literary / commercial novel is going with my resolution to just start it. But I realized I needed to get another book off my slate first. There's something I've been writing for a few months, and it's one of my cozy witch mysteries. And I needed to wrap it up before I could start this new book. And it made me aware of the fact that I often don't stick the landing when it comes to ending a book. I often rush the ending because I know how it's going to end and I'm not that interested in actually writing the ending. So I tend to rush it and then I have to go back. And this time I wanted to get it right the first time. So I've been working on sticking the landing, on not rushing, on tying up all the plot points. I think you've previously talked about wrapping up red herrings that are left hanging, or making sure that all the actual genuine clues you've left there are all tied together neatly at the end. And I'm trying to get this right the first time so that it needs only minimal editing when I go over it again. So that's what I've been busy with.
I do think that rushing the ending thing is particularly true of a murder mystery, because you're so relieved that you finally got to the person who was supposed to do the killing in the first place, and you're not dealing with a red herring, and you're like, oh, blah, blah, here's the whole thing. Yeah. Here's what actually happened. Okay, goodbye. Fiona, what have you been consuming this week?
Well, it hasn't been the greatest experience, because I've been reading over some older South African fiction for research purposes. So I've been going back like maybe 15 years to when this whole new third wave of South African fiction, the kind of post-apartheid fiction, was coming into its own. Everyone had finished writing about the TRC and put all that trauma on the page. And South African fiction was starting to diversify into genres for the first time. Mm. And you had your speculative fiction, your science fiction, your murder mysteries, your thrillers. They were all coming up. And I remember it as such an exciting time, producing so much good stuff. And when I go back and look at that stuff now, some of it was really bad. I'm kind of shocked by how bad it was and how cringy I find some of it.
And how excited we were by it.
We were. We really were. And, you know, when I look back at my old writing, it suffers from the same thing. And I'm not sure why. Is it because we tied our fiction to the moment? So, you know, when you look back and you see people talking about a message coming through on a pager or something, and you think, ooh, dated, okay. Oh, so that belongs to that era. Mm. And now we're talking about, enlarging text on our phones to be able to read it better, or whatever the latest habit is that people are doing today. Will that one day read as cringy?
Possibly.
So I'm trying to get to the bottom of that.
Possibly a danger of writing contemporary fiction is you by definition date yourself.
Yes, but why do certain books not date? Why do some of them just have that evergreen, ever fresh thing? You can go back to them 50 years later and they still hit the spot so beautifully.
We're back to the difference between you and me that you want to write literary books and I don't.
So you're happy to write books that will be read now and sell well now, but wouldn't you like it if someone read it in 20 years and still loved it?
I'd love it, but I think maybe I know my own limitations. Maybe, you know, I would love it. I would love it. So maybe I must try and write a literary book next. No, not happening.
So what have you been reading or writing or watching lately?
So I want to tell you, and I actually chose this because I want to tell you, Fiona, about it. I've read a book called Dark Matter by a woman called, I think it's a woman, called Blake Crouch. And it is a time travel alternate reality book. Ooh. And it's been getting a lot. I think I picked this one up off TikTok. And it's been getting a lot of good feedback and I was interested. And it's about a man who gets kidnapped from his own life and finds himself suddenly in another life, in another reality. But in that reality, he has invented a time travel portal. In his own reality, he hasn't, because he took a different, more domestic route and his great brilliance hasn't been used. And we follow the story and it gets quite complicated and quite like science fiction-y, but very satisfying. And I'm fascinated, by the way. I always love a good time travel book. I don't love a bad one, but I always love good time travel.
So our guest today is someone who has edited science fiction-y stuff, time travel stuff, speculative fiction, and all the other genres as well. She's also an accomplished writer, and we're looking forward to chatting to her. Our guest today is Helen Moffat. Helen is an author, an academic, an activist, and an editor. Helen is also a poet. She's the author of the poetry collections Strange Fruit and Prunings. She's the author of the Girl Books of Erotica. She's written two environmental books, 101 Water Wise Ways and Wise About Waste. She has also co-authored several books, such as The Art and Science of Cricket with Bob Woolmer. And most recently, she's the author of the novel Charlotte, which is really one of my all-time favorites. And we're looking forward to chatting to her about that. Hi, Helen. Welcome. And thank you for your time.
Thank you for giving me this opportunity. I am very much looking forward to it.
Helen, we're going to jump right in and ask you, how has your writing week been?
Absolutely terrible in one respect, because I haven't written a word, unless you count the odd social media post. But it's also been, for once I've got a very good excuse. All my time and effort has been taken up by the Books on the Bay Festival, which has been a wonderful and inspiring event, especially for writers. The odd thing is that even when I can't write, whether that's because of work or because I've got other bookish sort of commitments which absorb that energy, I always seem able to write poems, but never by choice. They're triggered. And they're the one thing that I always am able to spin out of thin air. The muse really does strike. And I recently lost somebody I loved very, very much indeed in a far distant country. She was like my British mother. And it came as a shock. It was sudden, although she had been very ill. And we had been going to see each other on the eve of the pandemic. And of course, all that got postponed, and I still have not been able to get on a plane overseas. So she got buried on a headland on National Trust countryside, overlooking a particularly beautiful part of the Dorset coast, Ringstead Bay. And she was buried next to her spouse. And she wanted to be in the same grave as him, but because she'd planted a yew and a holly on his grave, they couldn't dig it up. So they laid her out next to him. And her daughter sent me a photograph of her grave. And I looked at it and I just felt all the feelings. And at moments like that, I write poetry, sometimes terrible poetry, stuff I would never show anybody, but it's the one thing that I can immediately generate out onto the page.
You've plunged me into something that I thought I was only going to get to much later in the interview, but this is something I'm very interested in, is the inspiration for poetry and the writing of poetry and the way it's written quite quickly, but getting one art in a month can be quite an achievement. Can you talk to us about that poetry writing process?
It's the strangest thing because, as you know, I'm a great believer that most writing is a matter of application. You apply bum to chair and fingers to keyboard. You have a spare hour and you sit down and you write. Poetry is completely different. It's the only thing where, as a friend of mine says, it's like a bird flying into a room. You know, you have to catch the image or the words or the rustle of the feathers before it flies out all over again. So I've been known to pull over while driving and scrabble frantically in my handbag for a till receipt and funnily enough, switching record on my phone and speaking into it does not do it. I have to write the words down on some sort of paper, so I will literally stop whatever I'm doing, scrabble for a piece of paper and a pen, and I'll often just write down the words or the images that are flapping around, that have flown into the room. And then I've got them down, and that tremendous sense of urgency, I must get this down, dissipates. And then more quietly, in a more reflective moment, I can look at what I've done and think, can this be turned into a poem? And then I will work on it. And then the crafting starts, the hard work. I think it was Ingrid de Kock who said that she worked out that on average she rewrote each of her poems 11 times. And I've never forgotten that. That it doesn't have to be 11, but that it's quite a substantive process. But it starts with that initial rush.
Helen, when you were writing Charlotte, I remember you describing your writing process to me. And it sounded so absolutely delicious that I've kind of wanted to replicate it ever since, but haven't got it quite right. Can you talk us through what your day-to-day looked like while you were writing Charlotte, in terms of writing and revising on the same day or the next day? How exactly did you do that?
Oh, I love that. The first 30,000 words of Charlotte were hard, and I wrote while I was on stroke holiday, stroke research, stroke writing retreat with very dear writing friends who literally supported me through the process. I didn't write chronologically. I wrote all the most difficult scenes for me in Charlotte first, the ones involving, interestingly enough, death and birth. I wet my way through them while being fed cups of Earl Grey tea and chocolate Maltesers by the horror writer Sarah Lotz, she may write horror and thrillers, but she is one of the kindest people I know. But after that, it was lovely. I stole an hour from my working day, and I stole an hour from my resting day, and they were the two best hours of my day. I would go to a coffee shop with my laptop charged up, and as the start of the day, at 9 o'clock, I had to be sitting there with my coffee, and I would start writing, and I'd write for an hour. So my working day, as in switching on, you know, attending to emails, meeting deadlines, doing editing, wouldn't start until 10 at the very earliest. If I was having a really good morning, I'd push it out till 10:30. I loved that. And my strict rule my only strict rule that I can replicate for that was I made sure I was locked out of the internet, that I could not go online at all. I told the staff of the coffee shop that if they gave me the Wi-Fi password, I would leave and I would never, ever return. It was my me time, my Charlotte times. And then what I would do was, then I'd go on with my day. And at 11 o'clock at night, I would haul my laptop back out and I would revise what I had written that morning. And that was complete free time. I could write more if I wanted. I could edit what I'd written. I could go online and do a little bit of research into early 19th century garden design, whatever it was, but what it was pure Charlotte time. I used to anticipate that. I used to practically wriggle with glee. It was such fun. So I basically stole those 2 hours, but they were the 2 happiest hours of my day. And also, you do that every day for 5 or 6 days a week, and you land up with a novel. I suppose I should explain that my debut novel, Charlotte, is a Pride and Prejudice sequel. It tells the story, you may remember, of Lizzie Bennet, the sparkling, vivacious heroine, has this plainer, poorer, older best friend, Charlotte Lucas, who marries the absolutely dreadful cleric, Mr. Collins, and she disappears. Well, she doesn't disappear off the scene. That is what is so interesting. In Pride and Prejudice, hers is one of the very first marriages we observe, and I wanted to tell her story, so I did. But it's a standalone novel. You absolutely do not need to have read Pride and Prejudice to enjoy it and to appreciate it. And you are also allowed shortcuts. You're welcome to watch the movie or the series. That will help. That will increase your enjoyment of it too.
Fiona, you're right. That was absolutely delicious. I'm inspired. Sorry, I've got to go. I've got to go and write my 1,000 words. Goodbye, everybody. I'm going somewhere where there's no Wi-Fi password. Helen, can you give us a little bit of your background? Because we've kind of skipped that. And tell us, I know you come from an academic background. Tell us how you started out, kind of how you saw your career when you were 17 and where you've ended up.
At 17, it never even occurred to me that I wanted to be a writer, which was odd because I wrote and I wrote and I wrote all the time. But it wasn't ever presented to me as a career path the way being an academic was. And my parents expected that I would follow my father into academia, and my mother, being a librarian and a very senior one, assumed that I would have something to do with books, and it was understood that I would follow in these August footsteps. But I never thought about being a writer. And if anything, those ambitions and dreams were squashed. My parents were disparaging about them, and I sometimes rather gingerly tell the story of the first time I ever had a poem published in English Alive. And I was one of these infuriating children who was always getting prizes and honours at school, so I just kept quiet. You know, I didn't even tell my family half the time. But this I was really proud of, and I remember taking this poem home and showing it to my mother. And she was stirring a pot on the stove, and she literally stirred with one hand, and she held in the book and she read the poem. And at the end of it, she said, "Absolute rubbish." And she handed it back to me. And I remember thinking, okay, I did not write another poem for 30 years. So the fact that I've landed up as, and I always say this in slight inverted commas, an award-winning poet amuses me deeply. And I suppose the other lesson there is don't squash your children's dreams. Or maybe you should, given that poetry is hardly a way to make a living these days. I mean, of all the kinds of writing that you could do, it's probably the least lucrative.
But have you ever addressed that with your parents? Do they stand by that it was absolute rubbish, and that it's kind of despite that you have become an award-winning poet? Or have you ever gone back and spoken about that?
No, and I don't think I ever will. They're very proud of the fact that I am an award-winning poet, and I was with them when I won that Sala Award. I hadn't gone to the award ceremony because it never occurred to me that I would win. I thought it was just extraordinary. I thought it was extraordinary enough to have been shortlisted. So although I was invited to the prize ceremony, which should have been a giveaway, because they pay for your flight and your hotel really only if you've won. But my lovely publisher collected it on my behalf. And I remember my parents were thrilled. They were over the moon. But it's interesting. I've never discussed it with them, but when Strange Fruit, my debut collection, came out, I took it up and I showed it to them, and my mother started reading it. And that charts my journey with infertility. And a third of the way in, my mother got more distressed than I have seen her in a very long time. And the penny dropped that she wasn't just reading about my inability to have children. She was reading about the fact that they would never have my grandchildren. So I literally went and I bound up all of the poems that she couldn't read. And I said, don't read these ones. And my father very formally came to me and he said, would I be hurt if he elected not to read these poems? And I was so distraught at having distressed my mother so much that I said, absolutely not. In fact, if anything, I'd prefer it if you didn't read it. Because it never occurred to me that it was a loss for them as well.
Right. Can you talk us through how you not only became a poet, but started to see yourself as a writer? What was that process?
Well, you know, because I did go into academia, writing was bread and butter. You know, it was what I was paid to do. You know, course outlines, essays, journal articles, reviews, synopses, funding applications, abstracts. I spent my life writing and there was very little joy to it. It was just what I did. I mean, there are worse ways to earn a living. I loved the teaching component and aspect of my life as an academic, as a very, very lowly academic on the bottom rung in the English department at the University of Cape Town. So I never glamorized the life of a writer, and it never occurred to me that I could call myself a writer. It was just something that I did. And then it kind of crept up on me. And then I started writing poetry as a form of therapy. I was now in therapy and we were dealing with the fact that we were running out of options to try in terms of medical treatments for infertility. And I didn't know what to do with those feelings or how to sit with them. So I started writing down these little snippets for my therapist. And I wasn't going to show them to anybody else. But they kept coming and they kept coming and they kept coming. And she herself was an academic and a writer. And after about 6 months, she said to me, do you know that you've got a poetry collection here? And I was like, good heavens, no. And then the late, great, much missed and dearly loved and inspirational Gus Ferguson asked, he's heard about a poem. I think what happened was that I went out to lunch with a poet, Fionnuala Dowling, came home and wrote a poem and sent it to her, and she loved it. Interestingly enough, it's never been published. It's called Full Legs, and it's about my astonishment when I first wrote a poem, that not just that this thing had come to being on the page, but that it had legs, that it stood up. So she sent it to Gus, and Gus said, I want to see everything else. So I sort of scrambled everything together, and the next day I got an email from Gus saying he'd read my collection on the train, and he was so excited, and he wanted more, and he wanted this poem to publish in Carapace, and what was I doing about getting a collection together? So Gus and Fionnuala sort of picked me up and ran with me. And then the poems, for a whole set of reasons, spent several years sitting in a drawer. And then Colleen Higgs established Mudaji, a woman-only imprint, a woman-only press, and heard about this. And I sent her the manuscript and she wrote back, yes, she said, yes, I'll publish. So I kind of reversed into it. But with great deal of help and love and generosity by other poets.
Helen, I wanted to talk to you about the way that the literary space in South Africa has transformed over the years, and it certainly has transformed. The writers have transformed, the publishers have, but editing remains still quite white. And I know that this is something you are actively tackling and that you are working to mentor young people to become editors. So why is this important and what needs to be done for this transformation to happen?
Oh, gosh, how long have you got? One of the reasons editing is so very white around the world is because, as it is said, with increasing cynicism, certainly in the big urban metropolises of the Northern Hemisphere, London and New York City and Los Angeles, if you don't have a trust fund or family money, you can't afford to be an editor. They've worked out that on what an editor is paid in a publishing house in London, you cannot afford to live in London. So partly you need capital, you need inherited wealth, you need other sources of income. And it's no different here. It is an extremely, extremely poorly paid, as white collar and professional jobs go, it is extremely poorly paid. And in fact, when I joined Oxford University Press's Southern African branch, over 30 years ago, somebody had a leaving party the day that I arrived. And somebody looked up the Oxford Dictionary definition of a job. And they said, it is something in which you get paid a salary. And the MD said, well, we all know you can't live on an OUP salary. And there were gales of laughter. And I remember thinking, what? What do you mean you can't live on an Oxford University Press salary? But actually, you couldn't. You know, you needed to have already invested in property, or very often you needed to have a spouse who was the principal breadwinner. So now if you have just, let's say, black tax to pay, this is not a good career choice to go into. The second thing has to do with something I could unpack forever, but there is a history of colonial institutionalization and structures of culture and education. That means that power is seen as flowing from the top down in very strict hierarchies, and it's quite punitive. I call it the fear of the red pen. Mm-hmm. The notion that in turning in writing, there is something shameful and humiliating in having it full of errors, which is constricting for authors, and it means that editors are seen as grandchildren, if you like, of the nuns, the missionaries, the colonial administrators, the high school English teachers who beat you over the knuckles with a ruler every single time you made a spelling mistake. So editing is poorly paid, that's the reality, but it's also seen as something quite strict and nasty that's done by somebody very stern and judgmental. With the result is that I found that certainly, and I can only speak for Anglophone publishing in Africa, through, and that's through my contacts with a Short Story Day Africa project, which is an Africa-wide project, and only through my contacts with other peers and colleagues in African publishing houses throughout Anglophone Africa. And there is a sense of, well, very well then, we, you know, sort of the echo of the colonial subject is that we will just hand our manuscripts over to the West or to members of the diaspora and they will fix this for us. And there's a kind of a hands-off attitude and a giving away of power and agency. Whereas what I've always said is learn these professional skills. Learn how to do an extremely polished edit on both sides of the desk, both as a publishing professional and as a writer. The thing that I've always realized about this is that if you are writing in a language that is one of your mother tongues, or it's not your mother tongue, you can perform as well as any other writer because it's about talent. But you're going to have to give yourself more time. Everything is going to take you twice as long, and you're going to have to work twice as hard. And if you understand that that's not because you're slow or lazy or weak or your command of the language is poor, it has everything to do with the fact that the playing field is deeply slanted. It is uneven. It is full of potholes. And once you realize that, and it's the context that's the problem, you're not the problem, then you can start talking about transforming the publishing and the editing process, given the huge practical hurdles that I've already outlined. But the notion that paying attention to publishing professional and production processes is about negotiating an uneven, unfair terrain that gives some people huge head starts and holds others back, and saying, right, I don't give a damn. I'm going to outperform you with a sack of coal on my back and hobbles on my ankles. And that's if you even want to go there, you know, if you don't want to create your own cultural spaces, tell your own stories, develop your own cultural models, genres, performance modes. So you can be doing all of those things. It's very, very exciting. And in the days when the Short Story Day Africa project still had funding, those glory days of the early noughties, and also before the pandemic, we ran something called the Editing Mentorship Program, where I trained young editors working in publishing houses all over Africa. And that was wonderful, showing people that actually it is not complete fluency in English, which none of us are ever going to have. I still have to look up stuff all the time. That's not a necessary skill. It's an extremely valuable skill. But what you actually need is an ear. You need to hear whether or not a sentence sings or whether it stumbles. If it comes to a logical and a gracious conclusion, or if it feels truncated or rambly.
We've spoken on this podcast often about the importance of being edited and how everyone needs an editor. And I think you've mentioned to me before that you edited Ivan Vladislavich, who himself has worked as an editor. Mm. Now, he is a brilliant and articulate writer who is a very accomplished editor. Why does a man like that need an editor? Why can't he just edit himself? Why do people need editors?
I suppose for the same reason that a surgeon goes to another surgeon to, remove a mole from his face or her face. I must say that Ivan did not need much editing. And mostly what we did, those were the old-fashioned days where we did most of our editing by phone. You know, I would email him very early old what became in the end Word files with track changes, or I would mark his pages up with a red pen and photocopy them and mail them to him. But we mostly sat on the phone and got into fits of giggles, which, if you know Ivan, you'll know that we were very relaxed about the process. Ivan does not giggle easily. And we mostly thought up the most terrible and outrageous puns that we could put in the manuscript, and we would tell each other cat stories. But everybody needs an editor, because when you're writing, you are writing to articulate as closely as possible a vision that you have in your head. However, and I just explained this in an online workshop the other day, the biggest difference between the writer trying to bring something to life on the page and the editor on the other side of the desk is that the editor's primary question is, who is this for?
Right.
And you can't realize a vision on a page while thinking about your audience reception. Or you can, and then you start churning out, you know, sort of like airport thrillers and employing ghostwriters. You can always tell when somebody is writing with, well, it's page 13, I'd better give the first glimpse of the villain, hadn't I? Or I had better invent yet another romantic barrier between my hero and Shiro. If there's that kind of plodding self-consciousness, you're never going, which is a kind of self-editing, it's never going to work. So that was also why when I was writing Charlotte, I separated out those two processes so clearly. One at the start of the day was about creativity and nothing was allowed to intrude. And the end of the day was about going back and editing and researching and checking. But even then, I needed an editor. Everybody does. You can't hear. It's like you don't know what your voice sounds like.
Yes.
It's exactly the same on the page. You've got to be edited.
Can you give us tips for doing what you did at the end of each day with Charlotte, which is self-editing. When a writer is doing that very necessary process of self-editing before anyone else has seen the manuscript, what should they be doing? What should they be listening for or looking for?
I talk about this a lot when I give workshops, which funnily enough, I seem to be doing more and more of. Do as I say, not as I did. Read everything aloud. Although, frankly, you know what? Wait, scratch that. You're going to have to read everything aloud, but do so later in the process. What I would do at the end of the day was I would look at things and basically my biggest question was, am I enjoying this? Is this fun to read? Does it give me a good feeling? And or does it feel ploddy? Does it feel labored? And later on, you will have all of the feels about your manuscript, and many of them will be bad ones. I cannot tell you how often in late stages of editing, I have hysterical authors phoning me or meeting me in coffee shops and sobbing on my shoulder saying, it's a terrible book. I hate everything about it. But so accept that you will have all of those feels. But when it's very fresh, think, do you still have that sense of, well, this was fun to write? Ooh, I wonder where I can go with this. Ooh, I've had another idea. And also at that stage, you're still free to do the research. So you're still free to say, well, you know, the two of them are, you know, my heroine and a protagonist have met in this beautiful garden. What flowers are flowering in that part of the country at that time of the year? Let's go online and see what I can find. So I would say that at the very, very early stage, you've got to be able to play. And then as you do that, you start picking up the dreadful word echoes, the lavishing of adverbs. Remember, Stephen King says they've all got to go. And I'm not as harsh as he is, but I've never forgotten his line. You let they're like dandelions on your lawn. You let one or two slip by and the next thing your lawn is a wreck. So yes, I would say still play with it. I can talk a lot about self-editing, but only later on down. I want people to get as much out on the page as they possibly can. And the reason I allowed myself research at that stage, is it would often trigger new ideas for the plot or the story or the character. I think, okay, I've put beehives in the orchard. Oh, maybe the heroine's mother can be a beekeeper. And down a rabbit hole, a lovely rabbit hole, I would go. And I mean, that happens all the time. And a lot of that research just falls on the cutting room floor. But you're having fun. And you are giving depth and texture to your manuscript without realizing it. An awful lot of backstory never even makes it onto the page. But the fact that it's there makes those pages feel more substantial. At least that's my theory.
Helen, I'm very, as I've been listening to you talk about editing and the passion for editing, I'm very interested in how you found the experience, particularly with Charlotte, of being on the other side of the editing process. I love being edited. It's my favorite part of the writing process. How was it for you? Was it difficult to not be the editor of your own work?
Well, I enjoyed mostly the experience of having Charlotte edited. But I should explain that this is where being an academic was very good preparation. If you're an academic, you are used to anonymous peer reviews that sometimes tear you to shreds on very slim and shaky grounds. So I learned very strategic skills very early on. One is where you thank the editor for all of their comments and you say how helpful you find them and how you're going to implement them all. And then you don't. You implement the first two or three and you ignore the rest. Nobody ever checks. So I got used to strategies. By the time I was having fiction and poetry and short stories edited, I was adept at how to sift when to ignore a suggestion and when to embrace it. which is very naughty of me because my authors are not allowed to ignore my edits. They can, however, discuss and debate them with me, and some things I'm just not prepared to fight about. I think this word would work better. I think that adjective's got to go, but the author is addicted to it or invested in it, and I'm like, you know, by the time I was being edited, I had already learnt which battles to pick and which not to pick. And very often later, even after publication, my authors say to me, you know that fight we had about X scene and you wanted it taken out or cut down and I fought for it and I insisted on it and I've just reread my book and you were right. It should have gone.
Helen, what can you tell us about the sequel to Charlotte? I'm asking this selfishly because I'm so enthusiastic to read it, but maybe not much at this stage, but what can you tell us about your plans for that?
Well, it's terribly, terribly, terribly overdue. It's so late that I don't even dare ask my publisher if they even still want to publish it. But it is very loosely a sequel to Charlotte in that some of the same characters appear. And the idea was that I would use my PhD research on the Pre-Raphaelites and I would set it about 25 to 30 years after the events of Charlotte, which would take us slap into the middle of the Pre-Raphaelite Victorian era. And I remember thinking, well, how hard can this be? You know, I wrote a 100,000 word PhD dissertation on this. It doesn't work like that, I discovered. I had actually written quite a lot, but it was dead on the page. I wasn't enjoying it. You know, I was going through my dissertation and I was seeing what I could take out of my PhD and I was taking the characters forward. There were moments of glory. I went on a little writing retreat with, once again, Sarah Lotz and Paige Nick. And the three of us have form as co-authors. And I came up with basic plot lines and passages, and I loved writing those. But that was because when I think back on it, I think back on the glorious days that I had with two of my dearest friends, where we were all working on book projects and talking about our imaginary friends together, which is actually what writers are. We're a bunch of grown-ups who sit around talking about imaginary people, imaginary friends that matter to us. So I started writing a completely fresh sequel, which is about Hecate, the goddess stroke witch of the Greeks, who stands at crossroads at moments of terrible pain and lostness in people's lives. She's also the goddess of midwives. She's the goddess of crossroads and signposts. And when you are in a terrible trap, and it can be on the way to something joyous, but can also be on the way into the underworld, she will show up for you. And she won't necessarily guide you, but she will be there at those moments, almost like a duala, if into birth, into death, into life. So that's what I'm writing about at the moment, because that's... So I have this Pre-Raphaelite novel with characters that you would recognize from Charlotte, all mixed up with Hecate. And I'm turning it into an endless series of stories of people at crisis points in their lives when somebody shows up and it's clearly Hecate. Whether she's an elderly lady on a London bus or a South African au pair working in the US. And that's where I am right now.
Let's talk briefly about writer's block. I don't think Gail will be able to relate to this because I don't know that Gail has ever been through it. I had about a year in my life, not even the year my mom passed away, but a few months later when I was beginning to process that loss, where I not only couldn't write, I didn't want to write. I had no desire to be doing that activity, and therefore I didn't for almost a year. And then at some point, I kind of pulled myself together and just sat down and started again. And the first words were, they ended up on the cutting room floor, but then after a while, I started to write good words again. Now, I think you yourself have experienced that as a writer and have probably midwifed writers through it. it's real, isn't it? Writer's block is a real thing, and it can be very debilitating.
It is absolutely real. And the huge irony is that I have held writers' hands through their writer's block so often, and I have these little tricks that I try and these little tips, and they're very simple. You know, they're very straightforward. I've got a writing structure that I give everybody to follow. And I say, if you keep doing this over and over and over again, you at the end of it, you will have 500 words. So this is what you do. You know, you establish your topic, what you want to write about. You do what I call sorting the underwear drawer, which is where you sort of start organizing it into various themes. And then you structure it, you draw up a skeleton, and you create a little corporeal reality. And then you do that over and over and over again. And eventually you'll get so bored with the process, you will just end up writing. And I do that for a lot of nonfiction and academic writers, because they're usually sitting there. Their writer's block is often caused by the fact that they're sitting drowning in material.
Right.
So, but for fiction writers, I found that what worked best was taking them for a walk. I'd say walk your way out of writer's block. There's something about kinetic motion, about going forward, that breaks up the barrage. And then the third thing, which you allude to, I remember you once writing, I think it was in a dedication or an acknowledgements of one of your books that moved me so much, where you dedicate something to your mom and you say, you give this unbelievably poignant little line, to my mother who read everything I wrote. And I remember thinking, well, of course she can't write. This beloved pair of eyes is no longer there. So my third thing was like, if the pure structural thing doesn't work, if going for a walk doesn't work, go and talk to a close friend or a counselor about what is going on in your life emotionally. And remember, it's not the end of the world if you can't write. Unless, of course, you are some hotshot whose publisher, you know, wants X by Y for the summer catalogue and they've paid you a huge advance. And I have had authors in this category once or twice. There had been tears and wailing and tantrums before bedtime and terrible scenes of anguish because they have to deliver by a certain time. But for most of us, it's not the end of the world. So that takes a lot of pressure off you. But if it's actually making you miserable, being unable to write, sit down with somebody and look at what's blocking you emotionally. And then give yourself permission to attend to that first, which is why, you know, 4 years down the line, I've given myself permission not to mind very much that I'm finding it so hard to write Hecate, which is the temporary name for my new novel.
So about a year ago, you started a new initiative called Salon Hecate. Can you tell us a bit more about that and also where people can find out about it and upcoming events connected to it?
Oh, this is a story I love because it is literally about me emerging from the underworld. I lost the first year of the pandemic, 2020, to my own COVID pneumonia. And then I got long COVID. And then one of the standing jokes in our family is that my sister is less debilitated than I am. Then I lost the second year, that 2021, to my sister's experience. So it wasn't, and I don't know if you remember, but we had lockdowns well into 2021. And I was not leaving the home. You know, I was not leaving the house. I mean, I did eventually get vaccinated in the middle of that year. But I was still nervous. I was still weak. I was still profoundly traumatized. And I vaguely registered that an art gallery had opened up literally across the road. I mean, I can walk there if I wanted to. And a friend of mine, the very good photographer Simon Sefton, had an exhibition opening. And I had to go out, ironically, to the pharmacy. And he'd sent me an invitation, and I was like, I'm not going into a room full of people. You know, I wouldn't leave the house without a mask. But I thought I must just go and show Willing. You know, Simon has been a good friend to me and this is a big thing for him. And it was the first public event I went to post-COVID. And I walked in and I saw about 9 people I hadn't seen in 2 years. And they all advanced on me with glad cries and arms outstretched. And I remember thinking, oh, Lord, you know, sort of this after 2 years of avoiding people as much as possible. Mm-hmm. But we got chatting and I got talking to the co-owners of the gallery. I call them the galleristas, who were total strangers. And one of them said to me, because it is a lovely space, it's a beautiful physical space, beautiful art on the walls, pitched roofs, excellent acoustics, but not so big as to be intimidating. And the art is friendly. A lot of it is commercial. So there's nothing where you feel an idiot looking at it because you can't interpret it. And the owner said to me, you know what I really want to use the space for is poetry readings, but I wouldn't know where to start organizing them. So I said, do you have any idea who you're talking to? So we, you know, as one does over a glass of wine, we said, oh, well, we must talk. We must come up with something together. And we decided to run monthly poetry readings. At the end of their working day, they would keep the gallery open for free, you know, because it basically adds 2 hours to their working days, that we would all chip in for snacks and drinks. And I would do the advertising. And we called it Salon Hecate to start with as a joke. I remember Wendy Woodward, a local Cape Town poet, she walked into the space and she was transfixed. And she stopped and she looked around and she said, Helen, but this is such a gorgeous space. It's such a perfect space for a poetry reading. And the other thing was, is that all of the practical problems, you know, that, you know, I said to them, you need a toilet, you need chairs, you need sort of someone to pour the wine and wash the glasses afterwards and that sort of thing. And they kept on saying, we can do that, we can do that, we can do that, because they do it all for their exhibitions all the time. So what we do is that they pick the theme for the month, and that's the art that hangs on the wall. And then I pick a reading or readings that chime with that. So, which is great fun. And it's very general, you know, it'll be birds or fynbos or the ocean or sea life and gardens. So I pick poems that fit that and I ask local poets to come and read. And we have up to 5 poets reading. So I feel very bad because I ask people to drive all the way to Noorduk to read for maybe 10, 12 minutes. But mostly people love sparking off other poets. We all enjoy seeing how the work that people read weaves together, how it weaves into the art, into the art on the walls. So the best way to find out about that is to go online and look for Noorduk Art Point Gallery. All of our events for free are so far. And you do get a glass of wine and a snack, even if it's just a pretzel and a few olives. We have managed to keep it going now for 15, 16 months on that basis. And we all love it. And for me, it was a way of re-engaging with the writing life and the bookie world and a way of pairing up with other arts, which isn't something I'd given a lot of thought to. And as a result, we've had all sorts of lovely hybrid events. And by that, I don't mean online, offline. I mean, for example, the poet Fiona Zerbst came to read for us. And she brought with her 2 classical musicians who were doing their masters in music at UCT, who she's busy writing an opera with. And they have set some of her poems to music. So she would read a poem and these gorgeous musicians would play this exquisite music, either classic numbers that echoed her themes or work that they had composed. So I suddenly saw the synergy between music and poetry. I see the synergy now between music and art, the creative arts, all the time. One of our most successful events was a surfing poetry event. Do you know that I found 5 local writers, all of whom surf.
Wow.
So we had this wonderful lineup of people with all of this art, ocean art, because we held it in World Ocean Month. So there are whales breaching and beautiful blue-green seascapes and kelp forests, etc., all over the walls of the gallery. And then five surfers, stroke poets, stroke writers, reading their work. And we had an academic, we had a non-fiction author, we had poets, we had humorous poems, and people came in their droves, and it's the only time I've ever seen an event I've organized described as sick and kiff. And so it's very different. It's different every single month. It's just a lot of people don't know how to spell it. H-E-C-A-T-E. And if you're in the neighborhood, please come. We'd love to see you.
Well, it sounds absolutely wonderful. Well, Helen, we've come to that part of the interview where we like to ask our authors what they have been reading or watching or listening to lately. I have a feeling in your case it will be reading that has made an impression on them.
Right. Well, for once I have a lovely, long and worthy list to present as opposed to sort of generic thrillers, which is what I like to read to put my brain to bed at night. Because I had the Books on the Bay Festival coming up, and because of various salon events that are coming up, I've recently been reading, I've just read Sven Axelrod's Buried Treasure, his debut novel that came out last year and was such a sensation. And that was just a complete joy and a delight. I said to him, we've got this phrase that he likes very much. I said, you write caffeinated prose. It's full of this verve and energy. It's cryingly funny. It's often gloriously, raucously filthy. But it's just infused with this warmth and this energy and this kind of drum snare beat that rattles through it. He's got a completely unique style. I take my hat off to his editor for not messing with it. So there's that. I'm busy reading, but slowly and sips because it's delicious. Justin Fox's Place.
Oh yes.
Oh, it's a meeting of his skills as a historian, as a travel writer, as a fan of South African fiction and writing, and as a beautiful lyrical writer himself. So I'm reading that with great pleasure at the moment. I have just read a series of memoirs by South African writers. I've read Kathy Park Kelly's Boiling a Frog Slowly, which is about her 7 years in an abusive relationship. But it is surprisingly calm and dignified. It's like Tracy Goings' Brutal Legacy, books about frightful, hideous abuse and violence. And yet there's something reclamatory and dignified in the way they write about it, with a compassion of the years and very much with the notion we must actually, I want to give a roadmap to others in the same position. I recently read Marianne Tum's memoir, Hitler, Verwoerd, Mandela and Me, which actually came out in 2016, and I don't know how I missed it until now. It is brilliant. It moved me to tears very often. It's an exercise. If you can't afford a therapist and you want to know how on earth to live with total cognitive dissonance in your own family, with your nearest and dearest. I mean, her father was a Nazi. Literally. She's got the photographs. And she landed up being one of the very first women in South Africa to marry another woman. And to adopt two children with her. And of course, the Nazi adored his grandchildren. And I'm about to start reading Margie Orford's memoir, Love and Fury. Mm. And
You're in for a treat.
My mouth is watering. I'm so excited about it. But once again, I'm saving it as a treat.
Fantastic. Well, Helen, we hope everyone checks out Charlotte if they haven't read it yet. Despite being somewhat swallowed by the pandemic, it remains a book that has been received extraordinarily well by everyone who's read it and continues to find readers all over the world, deservedly so. We also hope that people check out your extensive backlist because there's very much to delve into there. And we are greatly looking forward to the Charlotte sequel. And we wish you well.
And I'm going to interrupt and I'm going to say to the listener that Charlotte is accessible even if you're not a Jane Austen fan, even if you haven't read Jane Austen and you haven't read Pride and Prejudice, you can still read and love Charlotte. So don't be put off by the feeling that you have to be a Jane Austen academic to get it. You'll love it just as a standalone book.
Absolutely. Gail, I think Helen is one of the few people I've met who can maybe match your reading speed and prolificness as a reader. That's a lot of stuff she's covered lately.
It was quite amusing to me because she kept saying, and I'm reading at the moment with some phrase like I'm currently reading. And I eventually wanted to go, Helen, how much are you currently reading? Because I might read a lot, but I'm always only currently reading one thing.
Yes, me as well. But I can see how people are reading maybe a novel and a book of poetry and some short stories at the same time. I can see how one would do that.
I can see how one would do that, but this one will not be doing it.
Gail, what struck you about our conversation with Helen?
Every conversation with Helen is such a rich thing. She has so much experience. She has so much knowledge. She has such a quirky way of seeing the world often. But the thing I took, and I took out lots, I've got lots of notes, but the thing I'm going to come back to is that she said the best thing for being sad is to learn something new.
Yes.
And I really loved that. I've been struggling with, I'm very lethargic in the afternoons at the moment, and it's really, I hate it. I hate not getting the most out of my day. I hate that I actually lie down and have a little sleep on the couch pretending that I'm not having a sleep. I can't bear it. And yesterday I got up and moved to stop that happening, and it worked. And I like this idea in a bigger way that generally the best thing for being sad is to learn something new. And I might write that on a piece of paper and stick it on a pin board so that I don't forget. What did you get out of her many gems of wisdom?
I think the main thing, and Helen didn't directly say this, but she demonstrated it so many times, which is that everyone needs an editor. Mm-hmm. There is no writer, no matter how brilliant, how articulate, even if that writer is an editor themselves. Mm. And Helen talked about her experience of editing Ivan Vladislavich and how he himself is such an experienced editor. And she, as a kind of rookie newbie editor, edited him. And they both found the experience very fruitful. So there is, even if you write the most grammatically perfect sentences and you read it over a million times and you think you've closed up all your plot holes and it's as good as you can make it, it still needs an editor. And everything she said about what an editor brings to the table, the things that an editor will alert you to, it just struck home and reinforced for me that no matter who you are, you need to be edited.
It can't be said enough. It really can't be said enough. And I would say it is the number one thing that makes self-published authors fail if they haven't got a proper editor to do the job for them, because you pick it up as a reader. You just know. And as you say, no matter how brilliant, it doesn't mean that you're not a brilliant writer. You are a brilliant writer, but you still need to be edited. Cannot be said enough.
And you need to take part in that process with a feeling of humility, with realizing that I am going to benefit from this and my novel is going to benefit from this and the reader is going to benefit from this process. So participate in it, cooperate with it, don't resist it.
Yes, cannot be said enough.
So that in itself, Gail, is really good advice to the would-be writer, and I think that's my advice for the week. But do you have anything to add?
So I wanted to talk a little bit about developing your character, and I've been listening to podcasts with writers who write the full backstory of their character before they venture onto the page. Mm-hmm. And then surprise, surprise, the character doesn't cooperate with their backstory. And I think that that's something to understand, that don't think if you are starting a book that you need to understand your characters 100% before you start writing. It works for some people. Apparently, they can be interviewed and answer any question about their character before they've started writing. For me, the character comes alive on the page. Mm. They start talking to you on the page. They tell you who they are. You suddenly know their backstory without having to think about it. It's there. They tell you, or it just arrives in your head. And it's a phenomenal process. So don't think you have to, before you write, know everything about your characters. You don't.
Yes. In fact, I've had the opposite experience where I've tried to write down every detail of a character and their backstory and the way they would react on the page. And that to me has actually taken away the hunger to write more about that character, because I've put it all down on the page. I know them. There's nothing more exciting to discover. So yeah, I would actually almost caution against that. I think there's a lot you discover during the process.
I think I agree.
So if, like us, you are looking forward to the sequel to Charlotte from Helen Moffat, if you've read Charlotte, and so many people have and have had very positive reactions to it, if something about what Helen has said has resonated with you, please get in touch. We're on all social media across the board, and we'd love to hear from you.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.